Hello and welcome to the Colcast. Today is February 4th, 2010, and this is episode 12. Tonight we're going to be having a discussion with Craig Issad from Hearth.com. He's a longtime industry player. He's owned owned Stove Shop. He's been in it for a while. How you doing tonight, Craig?
Very good, Paul.
Let's see, before we jump into the discussion, just wanted to mention tonight is our anniversary show. We've been at this for a year now. First show was on February 10, 2009. For anybody that's wondering about the math of the episode numbers, obviously if this was the anniversary, we should be on episode 13, but we skipped one in July, so we're on 12. all right, I guess we'll jump right into it here tonight. Craig, the internet is a big place, of course. There's a chance that some of our listeners don't know what Hearth.com is. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do over there?
Well, first of all, happy anniversary. That's a good anniversary. I've been following the board for a number of years, just going over there or sending people over there for the best co-information. Yeah, the internet is a big place. Luckily for me, it wasn't quite as big of a place back in 1994 and 1995 when I first started Hearth.com. And Hearth.com was really started out as what I might call a brain dump of a lot of the things that I learned being in the solid fuel and alternative energy business from 1978 when we started our store. And actually, for a period before that, I had lived out in the country in some rural places and burned wood and burned coal. So, you know, I was sort of bringing my experience to this grand new world of the internet.
Did you were you involved at all with the BBSs and the, you know, the old modem-based bulletin boards before the internet came around?
Actually, I was. I got into computers around 1982 when I bought a PC at the urging of my brother, who was actually an Apple guy, but the PC had just come out, and, you know, everyone said, oh boy, you know, everybody's going IBM. So I bought a PC for about $5,000 that had two floppies, and I upgraded it from the 16K of RAM all the way up to the 64K of RAM. But I never really got online with that. But a few years later, when the Mac came out, I bought a Mac in 1984. And then by 1986, I was online on CompuServe with the Mac on the CompuServe bulletin boards. They had a lot of the things that we see on the internet today. Of course, it was all in text, and it was at 300 bits a second, which is quite a bit slower.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I gotta love that. Back when, you know, getting a US Robotics 14.4 modem was the fastest thing on the planet. all right. So do you guys have a focus over there? You mentioned that you send a number of the people to ask questions about coal over to the NEPA Crossroads forums. Do you guys focus more on other types of alternative heating?
You know, my store, a lot of it, as I said, was a brain dump. So a lot of it was my experience. And I do have quite a bit of experience in coal. But, you know, realizing, you know, how special some of this equipment is, you know, no website can be everything to everybody. So, you know, we happen to have a community of users. You know, a number of them are coal users, but many more of them are wood users or pellet users. So, you know, when somebody comes up with these, you know, questions about equipment and stuff, rather than try to duplicate or find our few coal experts, we always know that there's dozens waiting over, or hundreds, you know, over at your site.
Well, Richard appreciates the traffic, I'm sure. All right, let's see. You mentioned that you've been involved with coal heating for, or coal and alternative heating for a long time. Besides Hearth.com, what has your involvement been with the industry?
Well, as I mentioned, I sort of started out just in the idea of moving out. I'm from the Philadelphia area originally, I should say, and pretty much a city boy, or a suburb boy, we could say, mainline boy for those who are familiar. And but we had this dream of moving out to the, quote, country. And we ended up fulfilling that to some degree. And in the 1970s, we moved out and lived for a couple of years both in West Virginia and Tennessee. And as you can imagine, I was exposed to coal in West Virginia quite a bit. and of course went out there and found people burning coal to in cook stoves to not only heat their house but heat their water, cook things. Same in Tennessee, people burned wood, but they on a cold night we'd throw some coal in the fire. So you know, we had an introduction there just from using it ourselves for our sole sources of heat. But when we moved back to the city area, that's when we decided, oh, let's get a stove to heat our suburban house. So that was sort of the beginning of the great journey then to our store and other things.
Do you still own the store?
No, the actual store, there's a number of physical businesses we were in. We started this store, which is Stoveworks in Medford, New Jersey, and we opened a second store for a number of years, which was Stoveworks in Williamstown, New Jersey. We ran the stores from 1978 to 1998. The Medford store is still there. I sold it to one of my employees. And during that time, we also dabbled in other businesses that are related in the solid fuel industry, including importing boilers from Denmark, including coal boilers. We imported coal boilers from Italy also, a brand that's known as the Simi, S-I-M-E. It's like a cast iron one like the Buderus. So we were involved in other aspects of importing, distributing, and manufacturing for that time. But in 1998, we sold the last of the physical businesses, and now we're virtual hearth industry members.
Do you sell anything at hearth.com, or is it really just a purely informational and discussion type place?
Hearth.com is purely informational. Just an interesting little story on that. When I first saw the internet in 1994, having a little bit of background in computers and in CompuServe, I had sort of one of those aha moments. I mean, it's a minute that I can actually remember. And the easiest way to liken it for someone who wasn't there was to say it was almost like that Martin Luther King when he said, I've been to the mountaintop. Or it was like when the settlers got to the top of the Appalachians and looked and saw, you know, there was a lot of land out there. So, I mean, I saw the internet and I was like, wow, this can't be legal. And I realized that, yeah, I realized there was just this tremendous, you know, almost unbridled opportunity. You just couldn't almost imagine it. And then after I did a little background work and things, I said, well, I'm going to get on the internet. I have this choice. I'm either going to take it and expand my physical business, you know, expand Stoveworks and some of the other things I was doing and use it to sell products, or I'm going to go with this completely informational model where we do nothing except for just, as I said, a brain dump, give away all the information I've ever had and answer questions and do things like that and sort of head in that direction. So I did sort of make that fateful decision, you know, to head into the straight informational area, and we don't sell anything. We just give away information.
All right. I guess we'll move now into our next kind of major topic here. We're going to talk a bit about the booms and busts and maybe a little bit about the future prospects of alternative heating and coal in particular. There's obviously been a number of boom and bust cycles over the past few decades here. Generally, they're associated with economic downturns and fuel crunches, things like that. Do any of these periods kind of stand out to you as having been particularly good for the alternative heating and or coal industries?
Well, when I first got into it was really when a lot of that dynamic change was taking place. If we think about 1978 and early 1979, I think this was the second oil shock, along with Three Mile Island, the Iran hostage crisis, and a number of other things came together. And it's for the people who weren't listening, who weren't adults at the time, it's hard to imagine, but it was quite an upheaval at the time. And this was sort of the shot in the arm for the entire solid fuel business, and even alternative energy, even onto solar and other things like that, even in early wind machines. But when we got into business was really when the wood stoves were starting to get big. But then, you know, being as we were located in the Philadelphia metro area, after we were in it for a year or so, we started hearing tell, you know, we saw people like, coal burns better. Colburn's longer, Colburn's warmer, and you know, we started hearing, and some of our distributors said, you got to come to these seminars and learn about these coal stoves. So that was sort of the first that we heard about it.
All right. Was there anything, any other kind of, you know, major events in the, you know, time since then, up to now, that you think kind of stand out?
Well, that time in itself stood out. You know, there were so many sort of little events which happened in there. Just for instance, what happened was, you know, here people had burned wood in 1978 and in 1979 and even into 1980. And they loved the idea of having a space heater, of being warm, of having their fuel, you know, where they knew where it was, where somebody wasn't going to turn it off. And, you know, all the same things that a lot of people do it today. And, of course, locally available wood, and for Pennsylvania, where we lived, locally available coal. But what happened is people still didn't know a lot about this. So, I mean, I was right there in the center of all this when, you know, first people came up with these retrofits. And one of the big stories is Vermont Castings that took all, you know, they saw this opportunity. So they took all their wood stoves and they put these conversion kits in them. You know, long story short, the conversion kits didn't work very well at all. And luckily, we sort of stayed away from a lot of that. But we got involved with a lot of the early players in the coal industry. Some of those brand names that people might recognize as being Certiac, Effel, Franco-Belge, Coal Chubby, Russo, and a number of other. You know, I was privileged enough to be in on a lot of selling those, learning how to use them, learning how to install them, going to seminars that the manufacturers put on, and it was quite interesting.
Do you think that kind of the level of excitement and interest in the alternative heating and wood burning, coal burning, etc., that you saw in that period, do you think that's carried through, or has it kind of waned, in your opinion, up through today, or up and down, or what?
I'd say much more of an up or down. I think the dynamic at first was, you know, let's get the wood stoves, let's burn wood, it's a home fuel. And then as people got serious with it in the colder areas of the country, like up here, they said, you know, this is great having the solid fuel, but boy, for those cold months, wouldn't it be nice to, you know, actually be able to live, to go to bed early and wake up late and, you know, actually still have a warm house? And other things of this nature. And this is where coal got very, very popular, because it was a complete luxury to burn coal as compared to burning wood. But then, you know, in the early 80s, when oil went down to, boy, 50 cents, 60 cents, 70 cents a gallon, the economic case was hard to make. So, you know, only a few of the diehards, you know, would have stayed through that period. So, Richard, and you may, and some of your listeners may even know more about, you know, some of those ups and downs. But, you know, that's a problem, because there is an economic benefit which drives people to anthracite.
Well, most recently, I think there were probably two kind of spikes in interest in the last probably 10 years or so. One was probably the 06-07 period. There was a wood pellets shortage that kind of went around the country, and I think that drove quite a few people over to coal. And then again in 08-09, when we had that oil spike, that the prices jumped up quite a bit. They came back down, and they've kind of slowly crept back up, but not to that point that they were leading into the winter of 08 and into 09. I think that really drove a lot of business. And then this year, we've seen a drastic downgrade in the level of interest and the number of sales within the industry, I think. At least that's been the case for coal through your board and through the contacts you have. Have you kind of gotten that same sense from the other fuel makers?
I've seen, if we're talking about a little bit more recent history, we could almost jump forward from those, you know, from those 80s and say almost nothing happened through the 80s and the 90s, which is a long time, unfortunately. And then the next little beep was Y2K. Which did a little bit for wood, and I would assume a little bit for coal also, because again, here was this little bit of a pack rat mentality of, at least I have some wood in the yard, or at least I have something that doesn't need electric, or doesn't need, if every all the utilities stop working. So there was a little bit of of an upswing with Y2K. The one after that, the next one that you're talking about, 2005, 2006, was driven by Katrina. And that was driven by oil prices that then spiked after Katrina based on the Gulf of Mexico oil platform. So again, we had this idea of, I don't want to be beholden. And then the latest one, which was perhaps the biggest of them, which was really 19, in some ways 1979 all over again, or the next occurrence of a true 1979, was this $4 a gallon oil that we just went through. Now, as far as right now, I think that what you're really seeing is, and this is more of marketing, and I've seen this all throughout the years. Whenever you have a product that you build a demand really almost artificially high for 1 year, then what happens is a lot of the people who are going to buy, they've already bought. So you've sort of, filled the pipeline in marketing speak. So there almost has to be a letdown after that.
Right. I just find it interesting. You, besides the fuel-based, the fuel spikes causing interest, it's also kind of like what you mentioned there with the Y2K. It wasn't driven so much by fuel spiking, but by economic interest, and then also a little bit of, Armageddon is nigh and we need to hunker down. Those same kind of fears are very prevalent with this current and this past recession here, the one that we're, kind of plateauing at the bottom on right now. Those same kind of fears are very prevalent, yet we've seen this, drastic downward spike in the actual sell-through on a lot of these alternative heating appliances. I just find it interesting that there hasn't been a softer landing, so to speak, on the alternative heating front caused by this other type of interest boosting effect with the economy.
Well, I think economy is the key word there, because if somebody doesn't have a job and the unemployment is running out in 20 weeks, they're not even going to buy the quote heating insurance policy, which was that was an advertisement we used years ago. That these solid fuel machines are a heating insurance policy. But when you can't afford to pay your regular insurance policy, you can't afford your extra one. But I wonder if fuel sales themselves reflect as big of a downturn, in terms of residential and anthracite, reflect as big of a downturn as the appliances do.
Probably not. I don't know this actually for sure, but I'd expect that with all of the coal stoves and pellet stoves that have gone out over the last 10 years as a result of these other spikes in interest, I have to imagine that the actual fuel sales have stayed pretty well up there, and probably has been what's sustained a number of the retailers who happen to also sell coal or pellets or whatever other fuel might be involved. Do you think that perhaps as we come out of this recession that there might be another bounce back into the alternative heating kind of, people not having been able to invest in it on the downswing, they might be more interested in getting into it on the upswing when they start getting some more money as a kind of a future. They've with all these spikes and these up and downs that we've had, maybe they're thinking further ahead now and they might be interested even on the upswing and even in the good times, perhaps getting involved with this kind of alternative heating.
Well, the old saying goes, the further the squirrel gets out on the branch of the tree, the shakier it gets. When we try to predict the future, but I will say this. When we speak about anthracite, I think we have a little bit of a marketing problem. And I don't mean that as that it has a bad reputation. I mean that it just doesn't have that jump on the bandwagon reputation that, sometimes pellets gets, just to use, sort of the opposite example where everybody wants to jump on it. But to answer your question a little more specifically, the answer is sort of yes. And this is something I learned in the in the boiler business. And that is that the world, or in this case, sales, it doesn't turn on the cycle that we want it to on quarterly, monthly. Oh, we have to sell more this month. With boilers, we were very used to people being exposed to them and then not buying them until they built their dream house. I mean, it might have been 6 years later, 4 years later, 10 years later. We had people sending us an advertisement that was placed 12 years earlier for information because they were building their house. So yes, I mean, but you have to wait for the world to turn, and the world, the question with all of us is always, can we hang on until the world turns sometimes?
Well, that's an interesting point you just brought up, the idea of these appliances being linked to home sales. Obviously, we've had a steep decline in new home construction as well as sell through on existing homes, and that doesn't seem to be anywhere near on the rebound, even as the economy kind of bottoms out and people are hoping for a return of employment in the next year here, that there really aren't any indications that there is going to be a fast recovery on the home front. So that might be an indicator that there is more tough times ahead for the industry as it goes.
Could be true, and which is where that word marketing comes into play, because the pellet sales, even the real strong ones, pellet stove appliances sales, the real strong ones that maybe ended 15 months ago, you have to realize that most of that occurred after the recession was really underway. Yes, some people didn't know it or how bad it would be, but here the recession was underway and more pellet stoves sold, than in the history of the world. And I should say that more expensive ones sold, that people that didn't have a lot of money and means and, weren't necessarily buying new houses were going out and buying $6,000 pellet stove installations, which is an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think on the there was definitely that kind of mid-2000s spike in the pellet interest. And I think there was a similar kind of spike in the interest with corn as subsidies went into effect for ethanol, and there's this big ethanol craze. There was a lot of people interested in burning corn for heating purposes. And I think that's kind of seen a similar waning in the last 2, 3, 4 years.
It seemed to be very strongly economically based, and as soon as those ethanol, whatever they give the tax credit, 50 cents a gallon, the government was giving, that made it so corn producers could pump up their price, and all of a sudden, it wasn't as competitive. One interesting thing, I'm just wondering. Let me ask you a question to turn the tables a bit here and say, do you ever hear pellet? Do pellet people who have burned pellet for X number of years, do they ever then go to anthracite coal from pellets? Is that something that you ever hear very much of?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely does happen. I couldn't tell you, I couldn't give you any kind of feel for the number or the percentages of turnovers on that kind of thing. But no, there are definitely people that do that. Usually, if they've spent a large chunk of money, like if you were talking about like a $5,000 or $6,000 pellet stove installation, if you make that kind of investment, chances are you're not going to be jumping off of that anytime soon. You're going to kind of ride it out and see how it goes. But I think a lot of that was driven, like I said, by the shortage of pellets that occurred shortly after there was this big spike in pellet stove sales. When that happened, people got very antsy and they started looking more toward anthracite coal, given that it's a much more stable supply. It's not tied to housing construction or furniture or anything like that, wood byproducts used to, actually generate the fuel. It's a much more stable fuel supply, and the pricing on it doesn't jump around like crazy. So I think there was a lot of interest driven into coal as a result of that wood pellet shortage that occurred.
Interesting, but just for the little historical aspect of it, from the 79 to 83, all the customers that bought wood stoves from us, I shouldn't say all, but most of the people who bought coal stoves from us in 81 to 84, which is sort of the big first anthracite, had already bought in wood stoves in the period, sometime from 1974 to 1980. And it was amazing how quickly, because they were already hooked on that, on the security of it. And then maybe they built an addition and put a coal stove, moved the wood stove out there. And they were already hooked on, being sold on space heat, being sold on solid fuel, having the source there. And it was amazing how quick they would buy the second stove.
Yeah, I think there might be some incentives associated with the shift from just wood stoves, like stick wood stoves, over to coal stoves, mostly having to do with fuel handling. With wood, you have to stack it. It takes up a lot of space. Depending on where you put it, it tends to attract rodents and other woodland creatures, taking residence, that kind of thing. Whereas coal, you can get more BTU per unit volume out of it. The price of it typically is cheaper than stick wood, especially if you're having to go out and buy the wood from somebody else who's already split it and all that. I mean, if you have your own source of wood, the economics of it don't necessarily work out right. But if you're having to buy your wood, if you got to buy a fuel, buy the coal because it ends up being cheaper month to month, year to year, etc. So I think there's a different set of incentives associated with that versus moving from wood pellets over to coal. There, the fuel handling is more or less the same. It's just a little bit of a volume difference. But typically, you're not buying, 5 or 6 tons of wood pellets. A lot of people, they'll buy them kind of a ton at a time. They don't have to store them because a lot of the places that sell them will actually, they'll sell them, on contingency, so to speak, 5 or 6 tons of wood pellets, but they only have to take delivery of 1 ton at a time, that kind of thing. So I think the incentive structure is just a little bit different on the fuel side of it.
Yeah, there's a little bit of, a little bit of the renewable factors in there has been in there with the pellets also. But at the same time, it does seem that it is getting people used to purchasing their fuel, which is a little bit more of almost a European, a European way. I mean, years ago we used to hear about all the briquettes over there, that it was just a regular thing for somebody in Germany or Ireland to go down to the corner store and pick up a 6-pack or 12-pack of briquettes to heat their house for a day or two, or to use their solid fuel stove. And I would hope that we're going that way, where pellets is part of that, anthracite's part of that, briquettes is part of that, wood briquettes, and maybe eventually we'll have some of the mixed briquettes like they have over there, smokeless. Some of them are peat, some of them are brown coal mixed with wood. All these different fuels to just sort of fill in the gap.
It'll definitely be interesting if that kind of day-to-day purchasing paradigm kind of takes hold here in the U.S. I think in Europe especially, I think that some of that is driven by just space considerations. Usually, people don't have, huge houses out there. They don't have a lot of land, especially once you get into suburban, definitely in urban environments. So I think there's some reasons why that has developed and taken hold over in Europe, and why it might not really ever take hold here in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, you're definitely right. I'm a little bit of a romantic in that sense sometime. I have a house in Rhode Island, and the one of the islands off of Rhode Island, Block Island. It's part of Rhode Island, but it has vast, vast peat bogs, and I've been reading some about them, and it's, oh, there's some good solid fuel there.
All right. Well, let's see. I guess being that you're in the internet big time with your hearth.com site, and we've already gotten a little bit of history on that. Can you talk a little bit about maybe when it took off? You said you started in the mid-90s. Usually, that was really the infancy of the internet. There wasn't a big spike in traffic going on to it probably until 97, 98, 99, as far as just general internet use and the consciousness of the internet within the general public. When do you think your site really took off as far as popularity?
Well, for a few months before I started Hearth.com, I actually had put my store on. And that was sort of when I got an idea of what the possibilities might be, because what happened was not only did I get to sell a number of what I call my dogs, you know, my stoves that I couldn't get rid of. I was starting to ship them all over the place. I sold a Vermont Castings pellet stove to a guy in Arizona. You know, I was getting rid of all my my warehouse stock. So I could see. And then I was also getting questions. I got a question from Israel on how somebody had to burn a particular type of stove that I knew the answer to by email. So I was like fascinated by this you know, idea. So I started Hearth.com in 1995, and it basically slowly built up the whole time. By about my first goal, after I saw, you know, a few thousand people had come in a month, you know, maybe 2,000 people. Well, you know, you think that might sound like a lot, 2,000 or 3,000 people. What's that? You know, 50, 60, 70 people a day, you know, had stopped in. And along with this, I had started an industry email list with insiders in the industry. So that helped shape it a little bit. They were probably sending customers there and things like that. And I remember thinking, well, if only someday I could get to 10,000 visits a month, you know, this would be, you know, I would be, you know, virtually, you know, the Hearst Publications of the hearth industry. Little did I know that, you know, these days, you know, I can have a day where we have 20,000 visits. But one of the first things that made me realize that there was something special, I went to an internet trade show, and it was very crowded. I think it was at the New York Jacob Javits Center, or it might have been Boston World Trade Center. And I went to lunch, and it was one of these very crowded lunchrooms where you had to sit at a table with many other people. And for those who were this old on the internet, back in the beginning, the first really big search engine was called AltaVista. It was done by Digital Equipment Company, a large computer company which is no longer in business. And the guy sitting across from me had a badge on Digital Equipment, and he was working the AltaVista booth. And we talked a little bit back and forth, and I told him my story. And about by then, I had about 10,000 visitors a month. And he got this look on his face like he couldn't believe what I was telling him. It would be like somebody from Google not believing what you were telling them about, you know, what your site was doing. And he started bringing all his business friends and contacts over and telling them about me. And I started thinking, well, yeah, maybe this is really taking off if this guy from the search engine is impressed. So I'd say that was really, you know, the aha moment sometime around 1997.
How do you think the internet in general has affected the alternative heating industry? How's it shaped it? And, you know, just generally, how has the industry taken hold of it, or haven't they taken hold of it?
The consumer has taken hold of it 10 times as fast and 10 times as well as the industry has. It's nothing short of a complete revolution in terms of consumer information. The industry didn't like that, and I still talk to people today, honestly, that I swear they're turning the clock back to 1996. You know, somebody will still say the same thing to me today sometimes that I heard. You know, the first things I heard was about Hearth.com. Well, you know, why should people come to my store? Because Craig's going to give them all the information for free. So, I mean, that's just an interesting little, you know, soundbite on, you know, this sort of model. I mean, this isn't just the hearth industry, but we can really look at the whole world as being this model of, is information something which is limited that you hold back and, you know, give me some money and then I'll give you that information? Or is everybody better served by, you know, just giving away all the information that they have, and then, you know, the commerce will follow?
Well, in the defense of these companies, especially the retailers at the end user level, they might not be actually selling the information to their customers, but they're depending on customers coming to them in order to have sell-through on accessories, on fuel, etc. The internet has definitely taken them for a loop as far as day-to-day contact, week-to-week contact with their customers compared to what they had, you know, become used to through the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
You know, there's an aspect of that that's true, but let's look at it this way. Let's look at a slightly more savvy retailer who would say, instead of a customer coming in and now I have to educate them from scratch, from the ground up, I have to tell them what every stove is. I have to tell them every little thing about every stove. Now I have a customer who comes in and says, you know, I heard about that EFM Stoker. You know, I've talked to people that want it. I think that's what I want. Now, how much has that dealer, you know, saved in terms of, I know from being a dealer, you know, it would be even the first time in, many times 45 minutes to an hour with a customer. So, and then you add in all the benefits of customers that can find them on the web and email them, and they can solve existing customers' problems and get new customers. So it's a matter of change. It's not a matter of, you know, the dealer that looks at that sort of narrow end of it and says, well, customer can go do this now. They're not looking at the whole big picture, in my opinion.
Right. And I tend to agree. I mean, you know, the business I'm involved with, Automation Correct, you know, we started, 4 years ago, 5 years ago now. And so we've been with the internet, you know, from the start, and kind of as a technology company within this industry, you know, we've seen a lot of reticence for adoption of our product just simply because it is, you know, technological in nature. It's not a, you know, simple rheostat or anything like that. You know, it takes a while for people to come around to it. And we've definitely seen the same kind of response, even ongoing to this day, as far as people being reticent about getting onto the internet, and embracing that for, what it can be. You know, that happens on the retailer's side of things. Although I think for the reasons you just stated, I think they're kind of, you know, scaling back their opposition, so to speak, and kind of getting involved. They're not necessarily putting up, you know, a major website or anything like that. They might have a website to, you know, have a map and a phone number and, you know, show some of the products they sell. But, you know, that's kind of where they start and end it at that level. They don't really get into it too much further. But on the manufacturer side, I think there's still quite a bit of reticence about getting involved with online forums and these kind of things, because they're not used to having to deal with things in the open. You know, the old way is people would call you either directly or through a hop through a retailer or dealer telling, you know, sending you up the line. And, you know, the problems are dealt with in private, behind closed doors, so to speak. And with the internet, everything's out in the open, and they feel that if they go out there and start participating on these sites, that they're helping open the can of worms, so to speak, as far as, you know, letting the bad press out, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, I know exactly what you're talking about. You know, I see two aspects to that. You know, one is sort of the reason that, you know, I won't write a novel, at least until, you know, I'm 70-something, is that, you know, getting naked in front of the world, and I mean that naked and, you know, dumping the contents of your mind and how you really think is something that, you know, you don't want to do when you're too young. You don't want to get your kids too embarrassed or whatever. you know, and then there's that other end of this secretive part of business that has been a way that a lot of it's operated. And, you know, you made me think of this major manufacturer who I can mention now because they're, you know, they've been out of business with a couple different one. In this case, it was Whitfield Pellet Stoves back in the early days. And, you know, we had sold them, and they had this major problem, you know, to the like with Toyota here with the electronics of their board. And something horrible was happening. I forget what it was. And the rep came in and brought me in the back room and said, listen, you know, I know this, you know this, the factory knows this, but don't tell anyone. Wait until a problem occurs, and then we'll fix that one. And, you know, I was even this was way before, you know, before I was big on the internet or anything like that, and I was just shocked. I was like, you know, this, you know, this isn't the way. And sure enough, as a result of stuff like that, that particular pellet boom, which was the first one, sort of died out because of that unreliability. So I guess my summary is that even though it's scary, you know, to get naked in front of your customer or, you know, to take care of the stuff, it beats the alternative, I think, today. And I think the people who don't learn how to do that are going to be left behind.
Well, in the fact of the matter is they're being stripped naked by their customers even without their participation. There are a number of brands of stoves talked about on NEP at Crossroads, for instance, that there's no manufacturer representation on there at all. A lot of their customers are very, very pleased. Some of them have some problems, and they're not interested in really dealing with them on a direct basis in the public forum. They'd much rather have them calling them up or sending them email if that's the way they want to go. They want person-to-person direct contact, behind some veil of some secrecy. And that just kind of continues today. Now, maybe they're just making a decision saying, okay, is it worth our time to, we know we have a fairly decent product here, so why do we have to go out and, spend a whole bunch of time being on the forums and monitoring them and responding to people, either whether they're, happy or sad with the product? Why do we have to invest that when we already have these mechanisms in place to deal with problems?
Well, you beat me to that, Paul, because I was going to say the whole last part of what you said is actually not only the truth, but when a manufacturer asks me, and sometimes they don't ask me, they sort of tell me and then ask me, I agree with them. I think that's actually a good, for most manufacturers, if a manufacturer is honest and, their basic system works and they're selling good products and they're not scared when something happens and they'll take care of it, to me, in some ways, it is better that they stay out of the fray. That doesn't mean they don't look at the fray and know that the fray is happening, and maybe when the fray gets extremely deep, they email or PM somebody and say, can we take care of this to fix the fray? But in general, I think most manufacturers are better off on that particular thing, letting all the stuff work itself out. And if they take care of the customer, that customer will get back on the board and say, they took care of me. And to me, that's the, in fact, I think it's worse when they try to get involved or they put an alias on and try to get involved. I think they really gum up the works.
Yeah, and they kind of take on a pseudonym there and don't let people know who they really are and try and deal with it incognito. They can be a problem, especially if they're discovered after the fact. Let's see, just take a look here at my list of questions. We've already kind of established that the industry is lagging quite a bit behind on, adoption and embracing the internet. What opportunities lie out there for companies willing to engage?
I think one of the biggest problems with either manufacturers or retailers or marketing on the internet is almost lack of marketing. I mean, we used to have a term for websites back in the early days where a manufacturer took their brochure and, they put a copy of it on the internet, and that term is brochureware, which means it's really just the brochure up on the internet. And I think a lot of manufacturers, they still don't get it, in the terms, the word grok, I guess, that comes from one of those movies. You guys are probably way ahead of me, but, or one of the books, The Rings or whatever. Do you really understand what's going on there? And what I try to tell manufacturers or retailers or anybody is, okay, here's the way this little revolution has occurred. You got a computer. They came out with desktop publishing. Well, wow, now you could print your own newsletter. But how could you distribute it? Now you had to take it and, tack it to telephone poles. Well, then you had a nice budget. You're doing good as a manufacturer. You printed some beautiful color brochures. What did you do with those? You put them in the closet. You sold them to the dealer. A lot of them sell them, or you give them to the dealer. A good dealer like myself hated to give brochures away because that meant that the sale was, that the guy was going to walk out of the store without buying. So we tried not to give, too many brochures away. And I try to tell them that it's the distribution that matters. In other words, don't just think about making this fancy website so you and your marketing people can enjoy it and you can tell your kids about it, or your dad about it, and your friends about it. But how are you going to get people there? How are you going to engage? How, in other words, they should. A lot of these people should be spending more money on getting customers and then satisfying customers and interacting with customers, as opposed to just spending more money on some piece of art almost that's on the wall. So I think that's one of the, you know, even though most manufacturers have websites, I think they get it wrong when they go back to that old brochure model of let's print it and forget it.
What can they do to better utilize the internet? Obviously, you know, every manufacturer can't be running their own forum sections and that kind of thing. That's a, you know, a relatively heavy burden for them to take. What other steps can they take to better get involved with the internet and better address their customers?
Well, you know, just as simple of a thing as just taking a figure and let's say, you know, one manufacturer or even retailer or distributor has a fixed amount of money. If they had, you know, $20,000, let's say, to spend, you know, on the website, you know, getting it up and this year and that whole marketing thing, well, in my opinion, it would be better for them to spend $5,000 to put the website up and the other $15,000 for everything from a little bit of search engine optimization, maybe for some updates, you know, so they could write, you know, some news on there and press releases sent about the website and on the website, doing advertising outside of the website, doing, you know, run-of-the-mill advertising on the internet and elsewhere to promote their URL so that more people went to their website. So in other words, you know, spending more money on actions that's going to get them business as opposed to this sort of static thing that's going to sit there. So I think people are investing everything in the website like with the idea of build it and they will come, whereas it really should be approached more like direct marketing, where if we spend this much money, this many people will come and they'll buy more products. Is that understandable?
Yeah, no, I tend to agree. And maybe, I don't know if a lot of manufacturers realize this, you know, some manufacturers, they're, you know, national and even international in scope. You know, they sell to a lot of people, but with coal in particular, it's highly regional. You know, it's the northeast of the country, maybe extending along the, you know, Ohio and then up into some of the more northern states there in the Midwest. You know, that's kind of the geographic location it lives and breathes in. And, you know, they can target their online advertising, you know, with the tools, either whether it's, you know, simple Google ads or if they sign up with some other internet ad placement agency. You know, they can, you know, target their market quite a bit. Plus, they can go to sites like yours, Heart.com or NEPA Crossroads, and, you know, get very targeted, you know, advertising on to, you know, in front of the eyeballs of people that are there specifically for their products. And a lot of them just don't do that even to this day.
I mean, you're exactly right, because, you know, first of all, not only is the internet the consumer's dream, because, of course, that research and everything they can do, but, you know, I was in this marketing and selling for a long time before the internet existed, and even the biggest companies in the hearth industry, the biggest national companies, which are, you know, other than the few big ones like Lennox and stuff, which we can put in a different category, but the big ones in the hearth industry are, you know, $50 million to $100 million companies. Companies of that size on a national basis, they can't even afford regular national advertising of the quote old style, you know, going in big circulation newspapers and magazines and TV. They can't afford that. So when the internet came along, it's the biggest dream for, you know, all sides of the equation. In this case, specialty, you know, specialty retailers or specialty manufacturers, you know, this is a dream. This is something we never imagined that we would be able to, you know, target and also spend that little to get that much. I mean, imagine somebody being able to spend this little amount of money and still have a quote national, you know, or regional presence. And, you know, although it might sound a little self-serving, let's say it this way. Any manufacturer of coal equipment or the cells call resident in the residential end. That's not advertising on your site, or any general hearth person that's not advertising on my site, that's spending money elsewhere. It almost makes me laugh, not because I think that, we deserve it so much, but from their angle. I mean, I open these magazines and I see the same companies spending money, to reach these limited circulation magazines that, sometimes nobody reads, or to go to trade shows where, there's only, 100 people coming around that might even buy their product, and they're it's just that old mindset of, here's the budget, here's how we spent it before, let's do it again.
Well, I agree. There's definitely a lot of room for improvement within the industry as far as utilizing the internet and getting out there, not only for self-serving marketing reasons, but also for the benefit of the customers, existing customers and potential customers. I think that's about it. We went quite a bit longer than we usually do here, so it's been a great conversation. Just wanted to thank you for taking the time to be with us today.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity, and I enjoyed it, and I definitely like to speak to you further sometime and learn more about the current state of what's going on in the anthracite industry.
Well, we got our podcast going. We've, like we said, this is episode 12. We've had 11 before. They're available over at nepacrossroads.com. Go on to the Coalcast broadcast with Mike and Paul and Mike forum, and they're all there listed for anybody to listen to. And for everybody that's interested in hearth.com, I highly recommend going over there. That's HEARTH.com, hearth.com. There's a ton of information over there. There's a FAQ with or a FAQ database with over 2,200 entries in it. There's a section on there with video and audio tours of various facilities. You have your own podcast over there, sporadically done. That's available over there. And of course, forums with, tens of thousands of posts on there, just waiting to be read and searched and, participated in. So definitely head over there, if you are interested in, alternative heating and, whether it be coal or anything else. Guess that's about it. This has been the episode for February 4th, 2010. Our next show is slated to happen on March 4th, 2010. Not sure about the topic yet. I'm actually thinking about maybe doing a boiler and hydronic heating show. Definitely want to get a couple of guests on for that, though. I don't know a whole lot about it. We'd want to get some people on here. So if you are interested, definitely get in touch with me on nepacrossroads.com. You can either respond in the thread for this episode, episode 12, episode 13, when we get that thread up, or you can just PM me directly. It's PVOLCKO. That's PVOLCO. Or you can get in touch with Richard over there, the mayor of nepacrossroads.com. He's Richard space S dot on the forums. And looks like that's about it. Talk to you guys later.